when famous. In an experiment by psychologist Jeffrey Haddock, people generated a list of 2 or 5 negative attributes of Tony Blair. After coming up with more reasons to dislike him, they actually liked him more. It was more difficult to think of many negative attributes, so they assumed he must not be that bad. This is what happened to investors when Rufus Griscom cited Babbel's weaknesses. By acknowledging its most serious problems, he made it harder for investors to generate their own ideas about what was wrong with the company. And as they found themselves thinking hard to identify other concerns, they decided Babbel's problems weren't actually that severe. Griscom saw this happen in the early Babbel board meeting, when he first tested his upside-down pitch. "When I led with the factors that could kill the company, the response from the board was the exact opposite. Oh, these things aren't so bad." Newton's third law can be true in human dynamics as well. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Just as presenting negatives can ironically make it more difficult for audiences to think of them, speaking up effectively depends on making the positive features easier to process. Unfamiliarity breeds contempt. Listen to this list of familiar songs. Pick one of them and tap the rhythm to it on a table. Happy Birthday, Mary Had a Little Lamb, Jingle Bells, Rock Around the Clock, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, Row 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 Your Boat, The Star-Spangled Banner. Now, what do you think the odds are that one of your friends would recognize the song you're tapping? I've been running this exercise for years with leaders and students, and it's as fun at a dinner party as it is educational. What was your estimate? If you said 0, you're either questioning your own tapping skills or seriously doubting the ear of your friend. In the original study at Stanford, after tapping a song, people thought it would be easy for a listener to guess it. They predicted that their peers had a 50% chance of naming it accurately. But when they went ahead and tapped the songs, only 2.5% actually guessed correctly. Of the 120 songs tapped in total, people expected 60 of them to be recognized. In reality, only 3 were recognized. I found the same results at numerous organizations. At a senior leadership event at J.P. Morgan Chase, CEO Jamie Dimon predicted that the executive sitting next to him would have a 100% chance of guessing it. He turned out to be right. But most of the time, we're overconfident in our predictions. Why? It's humanly impossible to tap out the rhythm of a song without hearing the tune in your head. That makes it impossible to imagine what your disjointed knocks sound like to an audience that is not hearing the accompanying tune. As Chip and Dan Heath write in Made to Stick, the listeners can't hear that tune. All they can hear is a bunch of disconnected taps, like a kind of bizarre Morse code. This is the core challenge of speaking up with an original idea. When you present a new suggestion, you're not only hearing the tune in your head, you wrote the song. You've spent hours, days, weeks, months, or maybe even years thinking about the idea. You've contemplated the problem, formulated the solution, and rehearsed the vision. You know the lyrics and the melody of your idea by heart. By that point, it's no longer possible to imagine what it sounds like to an audience that's listening to it for the first time. This explains why we often under-communicate our ideas. They're already so familiar to us that we underestimate how much exposure an audience needs to comprehend and buy into them. When Harvard professor John Cotter studied change agents years ago, he found that they typically under-communicated their visions by a factor of 10. On average, they spoke about the direction of the change 10 times less often than their stakeholders needed to hear it. In 1 3-month period, employees might be exposed to 2.3 million words and numbers. On average, during that period, the vision for change was expressed in only 13,400 words and numbers, a 30-minute speech an hour-long meeting, a briefing, and a memo. Since more than 99% of the communication that employees encounter during those 3 months does not concern the vision, how can they be expected to understand it, let alone internalize it? The change agents don't realize this because they're up to their ears in information about their vision. If we want people to accept our original ideas, we need to speak up about them, then rinse and repeat. To illustrate, which of these two words do you like better? Iktitaf. Sarek. If you're like most people, you'll choose Sarek over Iktitaf. But it has nothing to do with the word itself. Eminent psychologist Robert Zients called it the mere exposure effect. The more often we encounter something, the more we like it. When he showed people the nonsense words Iktitaf and Sarek for the first time, the two words tested as equally appealing. But when Zients presented either one of these words twice before the comparative test, people developed a preference for it, and liking increased further after 5, 10, and 25 views. To enhance your liking of Sarek, I embedded it 5 times in the previous section about Rufus Griscom. There is no such thing as the Sarek effect, and there was no social scientist named Leslie Sarek. I made them up to demonstrate the mere exposure effect. For the record, Rufus Griscom is a real person, as is every other person in this book. The mere exposure effect has been replicated many times. The more familiar a face, letter, number, sound, flavor, brand, or Chinese character becomes, the more we like it. It's true across different cultures and species. Even baby chickens prefer the familiar. My favorite test was when people looked at photographs of themselves and their friends that were either regular or inverted, as if seen in a mirror. We prefer the regular photos of our friends because that's how we're used to seeing them. But we like the inverted photos of ourselves because that's how we see ourselves when we look in the mirror. Familiarity doesn't breed contempt, says serial entrepreneur Howard Tolman. It breeds comfort. One explanation for this effect is that exposure increases the ease of processing. An unfamiliar idea requires more effort to understand. The more we see, hear, and touch it, the more comfortable we become with it, and the less threatening it is. Just as film is ruined when it's overexposed, and songs we hear too often become irritatingly stuck in our heads, too much familiarity with an idea can lead to boredom. But in the context of speaking up, people rarely oversaturate their audiences. Overall, the evidence suggests that liking continues to increase as people are exposed to an idea between 10 and 20 times, with additional exposure still useful for more complex ideas. Interestingly, exposures are more effective when they're short and mixed in with other ideas to help maintain the audience's curiosity. It's also best to introduce a delay between the presentation of the idea and the evaluation of it, which provides time for it to sink in. If you're making a suggestion to a boss, you might start with a 30-second elevator pitch during a conversation on Tuesday, revisit it briefly the following Monday, and then ask for feedback at the end of the week. When Carmen Medina became the Deputy Director of Intelligence at the CIA, she knew that if she wanted intelligence analysts to share information more openly, she would have to give them regular exposure to the idea. So she started a blog on the classified intranet in an effort to model the transparency she was advocating. Twice a week, she wrote short commentaries, expressing her views about the need for less secrecy and for sharing news, and suggesting that this would be the wave of the future. At first, many leaders reflexively dismissed the concept. But just as exposure research would suggest, the brief presentations interspersed between other communications and the delays between them caused leaders to warm up to Medina's ideas. Soon, the CIA's technology experts developed a platform on the intranet that allowed individual employees to set up their own blogs, and familiarity spread further. People began crediting Medina for their courage to blog. When Dennehy and Burke started to encourage people to contribute to the wiki, many managers refused to let employees use it. They worried about security breaches, quality dilution, and inefficiencies related to posting and accessing information between agencies. But as they gained exposure, they became more accustomed to the idea that they didn't have to get changes approved up their chains of command, and that it was actually more efficient to share information by topic than by agency. Within 3 years, Intellipedia was averaging over 4,000 edits a day. Due in no small part to her efforts, the intelligence community gained a vibrant blogging scene where analysts across different agencies informally share knowledge. Quitting before leaving. When I learned about Carmen Medina's story, I was puzzled about why she chose to continue speaking up after it sank her career. Building on a classic book by economist Albert Hirschman, there are four different options for handling a dissatisfying situation. Whether you're unhappy with your job, your marriage, or your government, decades of research show that you have a choice between exit, voice, persistence, and neglect. Exit means removing yourself from the situation altogether, quitting a miserable job, ending an abusive marriage, or leaving an oppressive country. Voice involves actively trying to improve the situation, approaching your boss with ideas for enriching your job, encouraging your spouse to seek counseling, or becoming a political activist to elect a less corrupt government. Persistence is gritting your teeth and bearing it, working hard even though your job is stifling, sticking by your spouse, or supporting your government even though you disagree with it. Neglect entails staying in the current situation but reducing your effort, doing just enough at work not to get fired, choosing new hobbies that keep you away from your spouse, or refusing to vote. Fundamentally, these choices are based on feelings of control and commitment. Do you believe you can affect change, and do you care enough to try? If you believe you're stuck with the status quo, you'll choose neglect when you're not committed, and persistence when you are. If you do feel you can make a difference, but you aren't committed to the person, country, or organization, you'll leave. Only when you believe your actions matter and care deeply will you consider speaking up. After Carmen Medina was silenced in her early attempts to voice her ideas, she no longer believed she could make a difference. She wasn't the kind of person to shirk her responsibilities, but some of her commitment had been shattered. "I was like a refugee on a boat, somewhere in between neglect and loyalty." Even after a few years, she couldn't shake the feeling that speaking up had torpedoed her career. "I was very hesitant to go back in there. I wasn't sure enough time had passed," she recalls, mulling it over. "You know why I was crazy enough to do it again? Because I was working for Mike, my favorite boss that I've had in my career." At work, our sense of commitment and control depends more on our direct boss than on anyone else. When we have a supportive boss, our bond with the organization strengthens, and we feel a greater span of influence. As I envisioned the boss who gave Medina the confidence to speak up again, I pictured someone agreeable, warm, trusting, and cooperative. So I was surprised when Medina described Mike as prone to cynicism and mercurial. Her portrait of him fit the profile of a more disagreeable manager, one with a critical, skeptical stance toward others. Disagreeable managers are typically the last people we seek when we're going to go out on a limb, but they are sometimes our best advocates. As much as agreeable people may love us, they often hate conflict even more. Their desire to please others and preserve harmony makes them prone to backing down instead of sticking up for us. Because agreeable people value cooperation and conform to norms, they should not be inclined to make waves and upset interpersonal relationships, management researchers Jeff Lapine and Lynn Van Dyne wrote after studying voice. It is often the prickly people who are more comfortable taking a stand against others and against convention. As a Google employee put it, disagreeable managers may have a bad user interface, but a great operating system. In one study led by psychologist Stéphane Côté, adults filled out a personality survey measuring their tendencies toward agreeableness and disagreeableness. For the next 3 weeks, 6 times a day, they reported what they were doing and how they were feeling. Agreeable people were happiest in the moments when they doled out compliments and praise, smiled and laughed with others, expressed affection, reassured others, and compromised or made concessions to please others. Disagreeable people, in contrast, experienced the greatest joy when they were criticizing, confronting, or challenging others. In the decision to speak up, whom we choose as our audience matters as much as how we deliver our message. When we speak up to agreeable audiences, their instinct is to nod and smile. In their effort to be accommodating and avoid conflict, they often shy away from offering critical feedback. Disagreeable managers are more inclined to challenge us, improving our ability to speak up effectively. A lot can be said for cynicism, as long as it doesn't go too far, Medina notes. I don't think Mike ever fully believed this was the way the organization had to go, but he had respect for diversity of thought. Even though he didn't necessarily agree, and we often did disagree on things, I felt I could be honest with him, and he would give me enough rope, but he would actually stop me before I hung myself. Instead of speaking up to audiences who are highly agreeable, we're better off targeting suggestions to people with a history of originality. Research shows that when managers have a track record of challenging the status quo, they tend to be more open to new ideas and less threatened by contributions from others. They care more about making the organization better than about defending it as it stands. They're motivated to advance the organization's mission, which means they're not so loyal that they turn a blind eye to its shortcomings. Mike loved the agency, but he was willing to be critical of it. He would get tears in his eyes talking about the mission, Medina says. He had a much higher tolerance for misfits, for eccentrics, than a lot of managers in the agency did. With the support of a tough boss whose top priority was to strengthen the CIA, Medina regained her sense of control and commitment. Knowing that her boss had her back, she was ready to resume her effort to promote more open information sharing. As she climbed up the CIA ladder, Medina noticed that her colleagues became more receptive to her suggestions, though it was mostly middle managers who dismissed them. Social scientists have long demonstrated this middle status conformity effect. If you're perched at the top, you're expected to be different and therefore have the license to deviate. Likewise, if you're still at the bottom of a status hierarchy, you have little to lose and everything to gain by being original. But the middle segment of that hierarchy, where the majority of people in an organization are found, is dominated by insecurity. Now that you have a bit of respect, you value your standing in the group and don't want to jeopardize it. To maintain and then gain status, you play a game of follow the leader, conforming to prove your worth as a group member. As sociologist George Homans observed, middle status conservatism reflects the anxiety experienced by one who aspires to a social station but fears disenfranchisement. The fall from low to lower hardly hurts. The fall from middle to low is devastating. Not long ago, I was asked to interview Google CEO Larry Page on stage. At dinner the night before the event, I asked him why he and Sergey Brin had been so hesitant to drop out of Stanford and make a full-time commitment to Google early in the company's history. His answer focused on their career stage. Had they already established themselves as academic superstars, they could have devoted themselves to Google without the risk of sacrificing anything professionally. Earlier in their careers, when they had no status, they were perfectly content to take risks. Page kept himself busy in college working on solar cars and building a printer out of Legos. But once they had made significant progress toward their doctorates, they had more to lose by quitting. Middle status conformity leads us to choose the safety of the tried and true over the danger of the original. Sociologists Damon Phillips of Columbia and Ezra Zuckerman of MIT found that security analysts were significantly less likely to issue negative stock ratings when they or the banks that employed them had middle status. Making a recommendation to sell a stock can anger corporate executives and investors who value the stock. Analysts with poor track records at minor banks have nowhere to fall by taking this risk, and star analysts at elite banks have a safety net. But for moderately successful analysts at average banks who are trying to advance themselves, a negative recommendation could be a career-limiting move. Does middle status really cause us to choose conformity over originality? Perhaps conventional people simply choose to occupy middle status roles, or have enough ambition to get to the middle, but lack the originality to get to the top. Not so. There's new evidence that landing in the middle of the status hierarchy actually makes us less original. When psychologists Michel Duguid and Jack Gonzalo asked people to generate ideas, their output was 34% less original after being randomly assigned to a middle manager role than a president or assistant role. In another experiment, merely thinking about a time that they were in a middle status role caused participants to generate 20 to 25% fewer ideas and 16% less original ideas than thinking about being in a high status or low status role. With the most to lose in the middle, they were more hesitant to take the task in an original direction. As Carmen Medina moved up the ranks, she learned that it was more effective to voice ideas upward and downward, and spent less time attempting to make suggestions to middle managers. Senior leaders saw her as one of the rare employees who believed there were things wrong with the agency, and also believed it could change. Her credibility was further bolstered by a growing following of junior colleagues. As she shared her views with rising stars in the CIA, they grew excited about her vision and granted her status. Younger employees appreciated her fresh ideas and looked to her as a real role model, which made it more difficult for others not to listen, Medina's colleague Susan Benjamin notes. It cemented her reputation and helped her get heard. Speaking while female and the double jeopardy of double minorities. Speaking up to an audience of risk-averse middle managers is challenging for anyone, but it was especially so for Carmen Medina as a woman in a male-dominated organization. When I first heard her story, I naively assumed that the days when women were undervalued in professional settings were long gone, and she would ultimately be evaluated on the quality of her ideas rather than her gender. But when I looked at the evidence, I was dismayed to discover that even today, speaking while female remains notoriously difficult. Across cultures, there's a rich body of evidence showing that people continue to hold strong gender role stereotypes, expecting men to be assertive and women to be communal. When women speak up, they run the risk of violating that gender stereotype, which leads audiences to judge them as aggressive. Voice is an act of leadership, and as Sheryl Sandberg writes in Lean In, when a girl tries to lead, she is often labeled bossy. When I analyzed my own data, the results were deeply disconcerting. In an international bank and a healthcare company, I found that voicing new revenue-generating ideas led to higher performance evaluations for men, but not for women. Other studies show that male executives who talk more than their peers are rewarded, but female executives who engage in the same behavior are devalued by both men and women. Similarly, when women offer suggestions for improvement, managers judge them as less loyal than men and are less likely to implement their proposals. Especially in male-dominated organizations, women pay a price for exercising voice. This helps to explain patterns of sexual harassment. In three studies, gender expert Jennifer Birdall found that sexual harassment isn't primarily motivated by sexual desire. women who meet feminine standards of beauty don't experience the most harassment. Instead, it is motivated primarily by a desire to punish gender role deviants, and therefore is directed at women who violate feminine ideals. Women who were assertive, dominant, and independent faced the most harassment, particularly in male-dominated organizations. Sexual harassment, she concludes, is mostly targeted toward uppity women. During her first attempt to speak up, Carmen Medina paid a price for speaking out. The range of acceptable behavior for women was narrower than for men, she says. During her second tour, she had a different experience. Because it was part of her job to put information online, she no longer needed to worry about appearing too aggressive as she voiced her ideas for transparency. In the early 90s, when it all blew up, my commitment to this change was confused with my personal frustration at not advancing in my career. It was always me-focused, Medina tells me. The whole second chapter of this journey was really very different from the first chapter. I was mission-focused. Extensive research shows that when women speak up on behalf of others, they avoid backlash because they're being communal. There's little doubt that the road was bumpier for Medina because she was a woman in a male-dominated CIA. But as a Puerto Rican woman, she belonged to not one but two minority groups. New research suggests that her double minority status may have amplified the costs and the benefits of speaking up. Management researcher Ashley Rosette, who is African-American, noticed that she was treated differently when she led assertively than were both white women and black men. Working with colleagues, she found that double minority group members faced double jeopardy. When black women failed, they were evaluated much more harshly than black men and white leaders of both sexes. They didn't fit the stereotype of leaders as black or as female, and they shouldered an unfair share of the blame for mistakes. For double minorities, Rosette's team pointed out, failure is not an option. Interestingly, though, Rosette and her colleagues found that when black women acted dominantly, they didn't face the same penalties as white women and black men. As double minorities, black women defy categories. Because people don't know which stereotypes to apply to them, they have greater flexibility to act black or female without violating stereotypes. But this only holds true when there's clear evidence of their competence. For minority group members, it's particularly important to earn status before exercising power. By quietly advancing the agenda of putting intelligence online as part of her job, Carmen Medina was able to build up successes without attracting too much attention. I was able to fly under the radar, she says. Nobody really noticed what I was doing, and I was making headway by iterating to make us more of a publish-when-ready organization. It was almost like a backyard experiment. I pretty much proceeded unfettered. Once Medina had accumulated enough wins, she started speaking up again, and this time, people were ready to listen. Rosette has discovered that when women climb to the top and it's clear that they're in the driver's seat, people recognize that since they've overcome prejudice and double standards, they must be unusually motivated and talented. But what happens when voice falls on deaf ears? The road not taken. Donna Dubinsky was just shy of 30, and it was the most hectic time of her life. As Apple's distribution and sales manager in 1985, she was working virtually nonstop from morning until bedtime, maniacally focused on shipping computers to keep up with explosive demand. Suddenly, Steve Jobs proposed eliminating all six U.S. warehouses, dropping their inventory, and moving to a just-in-time production system, in which computers would be assembled upon order and overnighted by FedEx. Dubinsky thought this was a colossal mistake, one that could put the company's entire future in jeopardy. In my mind, Apple being successful depended on distribution being successful, she says. For a while, she ignored the issue, thinking it would go away. When it didn't, she started making her case. Distribution was working just fine, she insisted. Her team was coming off a record quarter, and complaints were virtually non-existent. Even though she was the master of the distribution domain, her objections were overruled. Eventually, she was assigned to a task force that spent several months reviewing Jobs's proposal. At the final task force meeting, her boss's boss asked if everyone agreed to the just-in-time system. Jobs had the power and the majority following. Dubinsky was in the minority. Should she speak up and challenge the famously mercurial founder and chairman of the board, or should she stay quiet and keep Jobs happy? Although Dubinsky was one of the few women in a management position at Apple in the 1980s, it never crossed my mind that gender was an issue for me. She was committed. She had put her heart and soul into the company. She had control. She was in charge of part of the distribution division. She decided to stand her ground and restated her objection to Jobs's proposal. Knowing that she needed more time to prove her case, she met with her boss's boss and delivered an ultimatum. If she didn't get 30 days to create her own counterproposal, she would leave Apple. Drawing such a stark line in the sand was a precarious move, but her request was granted. Dubinsky developed a novel proposal for consolidating customer service centers rather than moving to just-in-time production, which would gain some of the desired benefits without the risks. Her proposal was accepted. "What got me heard," Dubinsky explains, "was output and impact. People saw me as somebody who could make things happen. If you become known as someone who delivers, you do your job and do it well, you build respect." She had earned status before exercising power, so she had idiosyncrasy credits to cash in. From the outside, the prospect of speaking up against Steve Jobs might seem a losing battle. But given his disagreeable tendencies, Jobs was exactly the kind of person who could be confronted. Dubinsky knew that Jobs respected those who stood up to him and was open to new ways of doing things. And she wasn't speaking up for herself, she was advocating for Apple. By virtue of her willingness to challenge an idea she viewed as wrong, Dubinsky landed a promotion. She was not alone. Starting in 1981, the Macintosh team had begun granting an annual award to one person who challenged Jobs, and Jobs promoted every one of them to run a major division of Apple. Comparing Carmen Medina's and Donna Dubinsky's experiences raises fundamental questions about the best way to handle dissatisfaction. In the quest for originality, neglect isn't an option. Persistence is a temporary route to earning the right to speak up. But in the long run, like neglect, persistence maintains the status quo and falls short of resolving your dissatisfaction. To change the situation, exit and voice are the only viable alternatives. Years ago, Hirschman alerted us to a major drawback of exit. Although it has the advantage of altering your own circumstances, it doesn't make them better for anyone else, as it enables the status quo to endure. Voice feeds, Hirschman argued, on the lack of opportunity for exit. In recent years, the world has changed in ways that make exit dramatically easier than it was when Carmen Medina couldn't find an outside position after her blow-up in 1995 at the CIA. Spending your career in one organization is a thing of the past. The dynamic labor market has made it possible for many people to land new positions with other employers. Thanks to globalization, social media, and rapid transportation and communication technologies, we have more mobility than ever before. Given these advantages, if you're unhappy in your job and it's easy to move, why pay the price of speaking up? In Hirschman's view, exit is bad for originality. But Donna Dubinsky's experience casts exit in a different light. After winning the distribution battle at Apple, she landed a senior position in international sales and marketing at Claris, one of Apple's software subsidiaries. Within a few years, her group accounted for half of all of Claris's sales. When Apple refused to spin Claris off as an independent company in 1991, Dubinsky was so frustrated with the lack of opportunity for impact that she quit. She jetted to Paris for a year-long sabbatical and took up painting, contemplating ways to contribute to a bigger mission. When she met an entrepreneur named Jeff Hawkins, she decided that his startup, Palm Computing, was the next big wave of technology, and accepted a position as CEO. Under Dubinsky's leadership, the startup developed the Palm Pilot, the first runaway success in the fledgling market for personal digital devices. The Palm Pilot was released in 1996, and within a year and a half, sold over a million units. But in 1997, when Palm was acquired by 3Com, Dubinsky did not agree with some strategic decisions. For example, when the finance group wanted to require all departments to cut budgets by 10%, Dubinsky spoke up in protest, urging the company to invest in areas that were succeeding and apply cuts to those that weren't. In response, she was told, "You are not a very good corporate citizen. You need to go back and do your share." Frustrated, Dubinsky and Hawkins left Palm to found a new company, Handspring, in 1998. After merely a year, Handspring launched the Visor handheld computer, rapidly capturing a quarter of its market. After the development of the successful Trio smartphone, Handspring merged with Palm in 2003. And a few years later, Steve Jobs launched the iPhone. Years earlier, Dubinsky remembers sitting in a room with Steve Jobs. He said, "There's no way I'm ever building a phone." Would he admit that he was influenced by us? That we made a great phone and he changed his mind? No, he would never admit it. But despite his stubbornness, he evolved. It was the impossibility of exit that led Carmen Medina to move national security forward. It was the possibility of exit that enabled Donna Dubinsky to pioneer the smartphone revolution. The lesson here is that voice isn't inherently superior to exit. In some circumstances, leaving a stifling organization can be a better path to originality. The best we can do is voice our opinions and secure our risk portfolios, preparing for exit if necessary. If our bosses evolve, as Jobs did, there's a case to be made for sticking around and speaking up. But if they don't, and our audiences lack the openness to consider a shift in direction, we may find better opportunities elsewhere. Questions may linger about what might have been. Had Medina left the CIA, would she have been able to champion transparency from the outside? Had Dubinsky stayed at Apple, would the company have developed the iPhone or spawned a different set of innovations? We'll never have answers to these counterfactual scenarios, but we can learn something from the decisions that Medina and Dubinsky made. Although one ultimately chose voice and the other opted to exit, there's one way in which their choices were the same. They chose to speak up rather than stay silent. And in the long run, research shows that the mistakes we regret are not errors of commission, but errors of omission. If we could do things over, most of us would censor ourselves less and express our ideas more. That's exactly what Carmen Medina and Donna Dubinsky did, and it left them with few regrets. Chapter 4. Fools Rush In. Timing, Strategic Procrastination, and the First Mover Disadvantage. Never put off till tomorrow what you can do the day after tomorrow. Mark Twain. Late at night in his hotel room, a young man stared at a blank piece of paper on the desk. Dripping with anxiety, he reached for the telephone and pitched some ideas to an advisor in a room several floors below, who then raced up the stairs to discuss a speech that would change history. At 3 a.m., the man was still working feverishly, bone-weary, almost in collapse from exhaustion. It was August 1963, and though the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was scheduled for the following morning, Martin Luther King Jr. had not yet prepared his closing speech. "He worked on it all night, not sleeping a wink," King's wife Coretta recalled. He was to be the final speaker, and his words would be carried on television and radio to millions of people in America and throughout the world, so it was vitally important that his speech be both inspiring and wise. The march had been announced to the press 2 months earlier. King knew it would be a monumental event. Along with the media coverage, a crowd of at least 100,000 was expected, and King had a hand in recruiting a number of famous figures to attend in support. The audience included civil rights pioneers Rosa Parks and Jackie Robinson, actors Marlon Brando and Sidney Poitier, and singers Harry Belafonte and Bob Dylan. With relatively little time to prepare for his closing speech, it would have been natural for King to begin drafting it immediately. Since each speaker was initially given a time limit of 5 minutes, he needed to be particularly careful in choosing his words. Great thinkers throughout history, from Benjamin Franklin to Henry David Thoreau to King's namesake, Martin Luther, have observed that it takes longer to write a short speech than a long one. "If it is a 10-minute speech, it takes me all of 2 weeks to prepare it," said President Woodrow Wilson. "If I can talk as long as I want to, it requires no preparation at all." But King did not begin writing out his speech until after 10 p.m., the night before the march. Parents and teachers are constantly imploring children to begin their assignments earlier instead of waiting until the last minute. In the self-help world, an entire cottage industry of resources is devoted to fighting procrastination. But what if the very act of procrastinating was the reason that King gave the best speech of his life? In work and in life, we are constantly taught that acting early is the key to success, because he who hesitates is lost. When we have a meaningful task, we're advised to get it done well ahead of schedule. When we have an original idea to invent a product or start a company, we're encouraged to be the first mover. There are, of course, clear advantages to speed. We can be sure to finish what we start and beat competitors to market. But surprisingly, as I've studied originals, I've learned that the advantages of acting quickly and being first are often outweighed by the disadvantages. It's true that the early bird gets the worm, but we can't forget that the early worm gets caught. This chapter considers the question of when to take original action. When you're preparing to row against the tide, you have choices about whether to start at the crack of dawn, wait until midday, or hold off until twilight. My goal here is to overturn common assumptions about timing by examining the unexpected benefits of delaying when we start and finish a task, as well as when we unleash our ideas into the world. I'll discuss why procrastination can be as much of a virtue as a vice, how first-mover entrepreneurs frequently face an uphill battle, why older innovators sometimes outdo younger ones, and why the leaders who drive change effectively are those who wait patiently for the right moment. Although it can be risky to delay, you'll see that waiting can also reduce risk by preventing you from putting all your eggs in one basket. You don't have to be first to be an original, and the most successful originals don't always arrive on schedule. They are fashionably late to the party. The Other Da Vinci Code. Recently, an unusually creative doctoral student named Ji-Hee Shin approached me with a counterintuitive idea. Procrastination might be conducive to originality. When you procrastinate, you're intentionally delaying work that needs to be done. You might be thinking about the task, but you postpone making real progress on it or finishing it to do something less productive. Shin proposed that when you put off a task, You buy yourself time to engage in divergent thinking, rather than foreclosing on one particular idea. As a result, you consider a wider range of original concepts and ultimately choose a more novel direction. I challenged her to test it. Shin asked college students to write proposals for a business on a university campus to fill a lot vacated by a convenience store. When they started the task immediately, they tended to propose conventional ideas, like another convenience store. When Shin randomly assigned some of the participants to procrastinate, putting off the task to play computer games like Minesweeper, FreeCell, and Solitaire, they produced more novel business ideas, like a tutoring center and a storage facility. Independent raters evaluated the final proposals without knowing who procrastinated and who started immediately. The proposals from the procrastinators were 28% more creative. Although we were excited by these results, we were concerned that procrastination wasn't the real cause of creativity. Perhaps it was playing the games that provided mental stimulation, giving people the energy to think more creatively, or that simply gave them a break away from the task to think. But the experiment showed that neither playing games nor taking a break boosted creativity. When people played the games first, before learning about the task, they didn't submit more novel proposals. To do that, they needed to actually be procrastinating while playing the games, keeping the business proposal task in the back of their minds. And when they started the task immediately, and then took a break before returning to it, they had already made too much progress to start over afresh. It was only when they began thinking about the task and then deliberately procrastinated that they considered more remote possibilities and generated more creative ideas. Delaying progress enabled them to spend more time considering different ways to accomplish it, rather than seizing and freezing on one particular strategy. Would Shin's findings hold true in the real world? To find out, she gathered data from a Korean furniture company. Employees who procrastinated regularly spent more time engaging in divergent thinking and were rated as significantly more creative by their supervisors. Procrastination didn't always fuel creativity. If the employees weren't intrinsically motivated to solve a major problem, stalling just set them behind. But when they were passionate about coming up with new ideas, putting off the task led them to more creative solutions. Procrastination may be the enemy of productivity, but it can be a resource for creativity. Long before the modern obsession with efficiency precipitated by the Industrial Revolution and the Protestant work ethic, civilizations recognized the benefits of procrastination. In ancient Egypt, there were two different verbs for procrastination. One denoted laziness, the other meant waiting for the right time. It may not be a coincidence that some of the most original thinkers and inventors in history have been procrastinators. A prime example is Leonardo da Vinci, whose original accomplishments spanned painting and sculpting, architecture and music, math and engineering, geology and cartography, and anatomy and botany. Scholars estimate that da Vinci painted the Mona Lisa on and off for a few years starting in 1503, left it unfinished, and didn't complete it until close to his death in 1519. His critics believed he was wasting his time dabbling with optical experiments and other distractions that kept him from completing his paintings. These distractions, though, turned out to be vital to his originality. As historian William Pannapacker explains, Leonardo's studies of how light strikes a sphere, for example, enable the continuous modeling of the Mona Lisa and St. John the Baptist. His work in optics might have delayed a project, but his final achievements in painting depended on the experiments. Far from being a distraction, like many of his contemporaries thought, they represent a lifetime of productive brainstorming, a private working out of the ideas on which his more public work depended. If creative procrastination, selectively applied, prevented Leonardo from finishing a few commissions, of minor importance when one is struggling with the inner workings of the cosmos, then only someone who is a complete captive of the modern cult of productive mediocrity could fault him for it. Productive mediocrity requires discipline of an ordinary kind. It is safe and threatens no one. Nothing will be changed by mediocrity, but genius is uncontrolled and uncontrollable. You cannot produce a work of genius according to a schedule or an outline. Da Vinci spent about 15 years developing the ideas for The Last Supper while working on a variety of other projects. The painting began as a sketch of figures sitting on a bench. A dozen years later, it became the foundation of the novel horizontal arrangement of 13 seated at a table in the famous painting. Although he was often exasperated by his procrastination, Da Vinci realized that originality could not be rushed. He noted that people of genius sometimes accomplish most when they work the least, for they are thinking out inventions and forming in their minds the perfect idea. Procrastination may be particularly conducive to creativity when it leaves us solving problems at moments where we're unfocused. Psychologists Marijke Wiet and Rose Zaks surveyed students on whether they were morning people or night owls, and then gave them analytical and insight problems to solve at 8 a.m. or 4:30 p.m. They were equally good at solving the analytical problems regardless of the time. But with the insight problems, the night owls did better early in the morning, and the morning people did better in the late afternoon. One of the insight problems asked students to explain how an antique dealer recognized a bronze coin as a fake. The coin had an emperor's head on one side and the date 544 BC on the other. When they were wide awake, they were more likely to engage in overly structured linear thinking that prevented them from stumbling upon novel ideas. When they were sleepy, they were more open to random thoughts and had about 20% higher odds of suddenly remembering that BC stands for before Christ. Since Jesus hadn't been born yet, the coin could only have been stamped more than half a millennium later. If you're feeling pressured to start working on a creative task when you're wide awake, it might be worth delaying it until you're a little sleepier. The discipline to delay. Procrastination turns out to be a common habit of creative thinkers and great problem solvers. Consider winners of the Science Talent Search, which is known as the Super Bowl of Science for high school seniors in the United States. A team led by psychologist Rena Subotnick interviewed these elite performers more than a decade after their victories, when they were in their early 30s, asking whether they procrastinated on routine and creative tasks, as well as in social life and health behavior. More than 68% admitted procrastinating in at least two of the four domains. Procrastination proved especially fruitful for creative work. The science stars used procrastination as a form of incubation to stave off a premature choice of a scientific problem or solution. As one explained, "Often when I am procrastinating, I really have something on the back burner, and I need the time to work it through." Another said, "In scientific work, ideas need time to mature, and procrastination is one way to restrain that urge to respond prematurely." After poring over the interviews with these precocious thinkers and doers, Subotnick's team drew a curious conclusion. Paradoxically, they wrote, those with the most and least at stake were the most likely to procrastinate in the creative domain. In American history, there may be just one speech as famous as King's, Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. In just 272 words, Lincoln reframed the Civil War as a quest for the freedom and equality promised in the Declaration of Independence. The formal invitation to deliver the speech reached Lincoln about 2 weeks in advance. By the day before his departure for Gettysburg, the president had only composed about half of the address. His secretary, John Nicolay, wrote that Lincoln probably followed his usual habit in such matters, using great deliberation in arranging his thoughts and molding his phrases mentally, waiting to reduce them to writing until they had taken satisfactory form. Lincoln ultimately didn't write the closing paragraph until the night before the speech, and it was the morning of the speech before he finalized it. He waited because he wanted to develop the most compelling theme. Early in the summer before the I Have a Dream speech, King sought advice from three close advisors about the appropriate content and tone. Then King had an extended dialogue about the address with Clarence Jones, his lawyer and speechwriter. King later asked Jones and another activist to start working on a draft. In the subsequent weeks, King resisted the temptation to foreclose on a theme or direction. He waited until 4 days before the march to actively begin working on the address. The night before, he gathered a group of advisors to go back to the drawing board. As Jones recalls, King said that this was such an important milestone in our civil rights struggle, we should make every effort to get the best ideas from key players in the movement. King opened the meeting by explaining that he wanted to review the ideas again and get the best approaches. By delaying the task of fleshing out and firming up the speech, King allowed Jones to benefit from the Zygarnik effect. In 1927, Russian psychologist Bluma Zygarnik demonstrated that people have a better memory for incomplete than complete tasks. Once a task is finished, we stop thinking about it. But when it is interrupted and left undone, it stays active in our minds. As Jones was comparing his early draft to the topic of that evening's discussion, something worked its way up from the depths of my subconscious. I deliberately procrastinated while writing this chapter. Instead of completing this section the day I had planned, I left it hanging, literally stopping in mid-sentence to answer emails. The next morning, it dawned on me that the Zygarnik effect was relevant. Zygarnik might have been pleased that I remembered her research on memory for unfinished tasks after leaving a task unfinished. Of course, delaying can go too far. "I love deadlines," Douglas Adams said. "I like the whooshing sound they make when they go by." 4 months earlier, Jones had met with Governor Nelson Rockefeller, a noted philanthropist whose family was supportive of civil rights, seeking funds to bail King out of the Birmingham jail. Rockefeller opened a bank on a Saturday and gave Jones a briefcase with $100,000. Banking regulations required Jones to sign a promissory note. Rockefeller paid for the note. Reminiscing about that experience the night before King's speech, Jones realized that the promissory note could be a powerful metaphor. The next day, King used it early in the speech. "When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned." When King finally sent Jones to create a complete draft, it was with the broadest set of ideas at his disposal. But that wasn't the only upside of procrastinating. On a Wing and a Prayer. Half a century after King delivered his momentous speech, 4 words are etched into the stone tablets of our collective memory. "I have a dream." It remains one of the most recognizable phrases in the history of human rhetoric, as it painted a vivid portrait of a better future. But I was stunned to find that the dream idea was not written into the speech at all. It didn't appear in the draft by Jones, nor did King include it in his script. During the address, King's favorite gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, shouted from behind him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin!" He continued with his script, and she encouraged him again. Before a live crowd of 250,000 and millions more watching on TV, King improvised, pushing his notes aside and launching into his inspiring vision of the future. In front of all those people, cameras, and microphones, Clarence Jones reflects, Martin winged it. Along with providing